This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 246. Today we speak with Rob Edwards about John Flavel on Union with Christ. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation in Reformed theology. This is episode number 246. My name is Camden Busey. I'm recording here from Wheaton, Illinois. A rainy day for me, but this conversation is going to be a bright spot of sunshine in my morning. We have a wonderful opportunity here to speak about a great topic. Let me introduce to you our panel. We have our regular, Jared Oliphant, who is regional coordinator for Westminster Theological Seminary, working out of Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome back, Jared. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be here. I love the weather metaphor.
Yeah. Excellent. Pretty corny, but this stuff just comes out sometimes. But we are delighted, very excited to welcome to the program for the first time Rob Edwards, who is church planter with Mercy Presbyterian Church. It's a PCA church in Forest, Virginia, which is just outside of Lynchburg. Welcome to the program, Rob. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I appreciate the invitation. It's a bright, sunny day here in Central Virginia. So
I knew it was nice somewhere.
Maybe more than you.
Well, we are really excited here. Rob graduated from Westminster Theological Seminary in 1999, and then he went on to Reformed University Fellowship, where he became the campus minister of the University of Georgia. So down there at UGA, ministering to the Bulldogs, right, Rob?
No dogs.
Yeah, there we go. Well, it's a great opportunity for us to have you on, and we're very thankful to speak with you. We're going to speak today about an article that Rob wrote in the Westminster Theological Journal, volume 74, just last year, or actually publication date 2012, titled John Flavel on the Priority of Union with Christ, Further Historical Perspective on the Structure of Reformed Soteriology. Really great article and a great discussion ahead of us. But before we get there, I do need to mention that Christ the Center is listener supported. And we would encourage you to visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate today to pledge your support. We have needs. If any of you have been to the website lately, you'll see that it's not fast. So we're working on that, but we are growing maybe a little bit too fast for our current provisions. So visit us online today. We really need some more supporters. Some $5, $10 a month supporters are absolutely critical to our day-to-day activities. And the web server costs are going to increase here shortly. And we want to get everything running smoothly so that there is no interruptions in your Reformed theological media. So visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate. We want to thank everybody for their support of Reformed Forum in this particular program, Christ the Center. Jared, do we have anything to mention before we get started in our regular program?
Oh, man, I didn't even think about that beforehand.
Neither
we usually mention conferences. Gosh, I'll be at so many things coming up this fall. This is definitely the height of conference season, September and October. But I'll mention I'll be at the Desiring God conference with Jonathan Brack. Looking forward to that. Number of good speakers. That conference is on sanctification, so it's relevant to what we're going to be talking about today. And I probably won't mention everything, but maybe I'll either put it in the comments or show notes or something. Or
And you usually tweet
to tweets or something.
Yeah, you can follow Jared at Jared Oliphant, and you'll get plenty of updates and always know where you are.
Yeah, true. Unfortunately,
no, it's good. It's a good way to provide that information to the people that want it. Don't have a whole lot here either, but I do want to mention, of course, do some cross-promotion, that East of Eden is now active. It's a new program that Reformed Forum is producing, mainly with David Filson, Jeff Waddington, Nick Batzig, and Craig Beal. all guys that are very much interested in Jonathan Edwards. And so each week they take a particular sermon or maybe an article or a portion of a book, something that Edwards has written, and dissect it and talk about the biblical and systematic theology of Jonathan Edwards. So visit us online at reformedforum.org/programs/East of Eden, I believe, to get that. You can subscribe to that particular feed, or you can just subscribe to the general Reformed Forum feed and get everything that we do. We hope to have some new programs coming out soon. We have several in the works, and we want to revive a few. It's an exciting time, but again, you got to visit us online to get it. And of course, we rely on the support to keep doing these things too. So we want to encourage people to check all those things out. Well, I'm very excited about today's episode here to discuss John Flavel on the priority of union with Christ. I read this article in the Westminster Theological Journal several months ago and was very excited and immediately wanted to book you, Rob. And it's been a long time coming for me, but it's going to be really exciting, and I hope we'll open the eyes to many of our listeners and help them to understand some of the history, especially within the Puritan tradition. Now, one thing, of course, many of our listeners know is that this subject of union with Christ and how justification and sanctification in particular relate to one another has been a hot topic. And there's been some friendly debate on the subject. There's been several articles and books written over the last 5 years or so. You've actually written a very helpful annotated guide or a bibliography of many of those resources. We'll try to put a link to those, to that piece in the episode notes. But, Rob, could you just explain to us why this issue is bigger than just the last 5 or 10 years and explain to us just your desires in doing this research and writing this piece? What were your goals? What were your aims?
Yeah, I do think it's come to the fore more in the past, 6-7 years or so. I think what's brought out some of the friendly debate has centers around discussions of the role of union with Christ and the new perspective and federal vision.
Oh yeah,
and then I think that's brought out differing emphasis among those who are critiquing the federal vision and the new perspective, which diminishes the Reformed understanding traditionally of justification and imputation. And so you've had two groups engaging, and then they've begun to engage one another as well. Those who want to continue to emphasize the centrality of union with Christ while maintaining the importance of justification. And then another group that more wants to highlight justification itself as the prime benefit and seeing all the other aspects of salvation coalescing around justification in one way or another. But I do think, and I mentioned this briefly in my introduction, that this has been a continuing debate or a continuing conversation in one way or another, stretching back into the 17th century. At different times, union with Christ has been emphasized, and then the benefits have been emphasized, and it's gone back and forth. So I think it is a conversation that's been happening in one way or another for centuries. And my interest has been following some of this debate and keeping up with the articles. But then had been reading Flavel as well, started reading him probably in 2005, 2006, and not looking necessarily for what he had to say about union with Christ as much as I was exploring what he said about sanctification, but found that the way he spoke about union with Christ fit very well with one side of this debate. And thought he could help shed light on some of the historical theological questions that have been raised. So that's, in general, kind of how became interested in what was going on.
Interesting. Now, have you been following this intently for quite a while, or did this research spring up on you in a short amount of time? It seems like you're very well-versed, especially with the bibliography. It has been very thorough and pointed out a number of articles that I didn't even know about yet. So I was very thankful for that. But has this been something
I had discovered recently, yeah, too? But I think I had been more or less keeping up along the way.
Okay.
And, you know, of course, as a graduate of Westminster and a student of Dr. Gaffin and Dr. Ferguson, had been introduced to some of these themes. And,
right.
And after graduating, had kept up with some of the things that had been written. I think Gaffin probably starting maybe in the late 90s, at least when I saw this, you know, I'd heard the exegetical arguments, the theological statements of how union with Christ fit within the structure of salvation. But then Gaffin wrote a few articles talking about how this was seen in Calvin and then the Westminster Standards. And so my question, what I thought with the reason I thought Flavel was beneficial is he confirmed, I felt, that trajectory. You know, again, hearing the biblical theological rationale for the importance of union with Christ and the structure of salvation, and then seeing those who argue for it in Calvin and then the Westminster Standards. Well, Flavel provides a later witness to that development. And mm-hmm. so that's why I thought he was a helpful figure to shed light on the development of those themes.
That's useful. One thing that's also interesting, Jared, you put in the notes here this question about campus ministry. Would you want to follow up on that, Jared? I think this is an interesting subject.
Yeah, definitely. You know, just you have what seems like two sides going on in your personal biography, Rob. There's the on the ground type of ministry that's ministering to college students and you know, needing to be practical, and then you have, you know, this more some might call academic interest. So, you know, some might wonder, are the two connected? Is this kind of two separate sides of you, or are they informing one another? And I should also mention, I'm definitely aware of the piece that you wrote on sanctification for the RUF website. So, you know, RUF ministers and RUF students can read that, and I commend it. It's excellent. Maybe we can put a link to that as well. But in your mind, how do you see this issue relating to soteriology that can sometimes get a little bit abstract and pretty detailed, and then what you're saying to college students in the midst of what they're going through?
Yeah. And of course, now in ministry in the local church is the same thing. I would say they're definitely, though this paper is definitely academic and focusing on your particular issue within historical theology, while that's true, Flavel was definitely a pastor. He was an on-the-ground minister, and these just about all of his works are collections of sermons that he wrote, that he preached. And so I think that's important to keep in mind, that Flavel, as he discusses these things, he's discussing them as a minister of the gospel, as a pastor. And he sees these things as very important to communicate, and he does so not in an abstract way, though, you know, dealing with it, you know, in terms of historical theology, it can definitely come across that way. But he's very pastoral. And for me, it's first a matter of pastoral theology, how to talk about the gospel. How do we understand the relationship between the different things we receive from Christ, the relationship between our justification and the status we have because of Jesus's righteousness? But then what's the relationship of that and how we talk about sanctification, the call to follow Christ, to be conformed to his image, to put sin to death, to be enlivened, to put on Christ? What do those have to do with one another? And so I think they're very pastoral issues. And of course, they're first pastoral issues of how do we talk about the gospel? How do we understand the various parts of it, the various aspects, and how they fit together, and how we help people understand that, to encourage them to look to Jesus, both as they struggle with the guilt of their sin, which is real, and the shame associated with it, but also as they struggle against the power of sin and the continuing struggle with temptation. How does the same gospel that comes from Jesus answer all of those questions? And I think that's ultimately what this topic is about.
Hmm. I think that's really important and key. This really addresses some very deep and foundational concerns. It's not simply an academic exercise, is it?
That's right, yeah. Definitely pastoral at heart.
it's interesting to see that connection there and to see these things at work. And I notice, you know, this feature and this teaching comes into play in counseling and preaching and all sorts of avenues. And it's not to say that you take this as the only way to speak about the gospel, or this is the exclusive thing you talk about and never mention anything else, but it's a foundational issue and a context in through which we understand how we relate and how we are accepted in Christ to the Father and the benefits that we receive from Christ. So when we understand that, we start to see its implications in a number of different avenues. Now, can you describe a little bit about John Flavel to some of the listeners so they can understand who he was, maybe his dates and what his significance is in the theological world?
Yeah, sure. Flavel was, he kind of came of age during the turmoil of the middle of the 17th century, the middle of the 1600s in England. He was a Puritan.
Yeah.
He was born in 1627 or 28, somewhere around there, and died in 1691. He was educated at Oxford, graduated in I think 1650, and was ordained that same year. His father was a minister as well. And in 1656, he was called to pastor a congregation in Dartmouth, which is a port city in the south of England. And really, the remainder of his life was spent ministering to the people of that city. When he could, anyway, because of course, with the turmoil, there were several times that he was forced to leave his pastorate with the Act of Uniformity in 1660, the return of Charles the Second. He was forced to leave his congregation there, and was able to return with a few different times with some of the Declaration of Indulgence, which allowed him to return, but really only entered freely back into his pastorate towards the end of his life with the Glorious Revolution, and he died soon after that, 1691. So,
wow.
So he was a minister of the gospel. He, interestingly, too, he was a Presbyterian initially, but later as he returned, and I'm not sure what the circumstances were, he returned as a congregational minister in the midst of all the turmoil. And so that's kind of who he was. And he was also immensely popular. He he wrote not just really not primarily theological works, but it's collections of his sermons. And probably the most well known today is The Mystery of Providence. I think the Banner of Truth has kept that in print as a Puritan paperback, and it's probably the one most people are familiar with and associate with John Flavel's name. But of course, that was one small piece within six volumes of his collected works. He wrote a lot more than that. But I think you see his heart in that pastorally. He also wrote works like Husbandry Spiritualized and talked about agriculture, farmers, you know, trying to connect the gospel with farmers. He wrote Navigation Spiritualized, trying to connect the gospel with seafarers as he was in a city. So, yeah, he really made an effort to communicate the gospel to his people.
Wow.
But along with being very popular, he was also very highly regarded by others. And his published works, Increase Mather, who was president of Harvard at the time, wrote the foreword to one of his books later in his life, which was England's Duty in This Present Gospel Liberty. That's the title of Flavel's work. And Increase Mather speaks very highly of him and others. You know, throughout, really, he was really popular. His works remained very important through the 1700s as well. You'll find him quoted frequently in by Jonathan Edwards and George Whitfield. Archibald Alexander, the first president of Princeton Seminary, said his quote was that he owed more to John Flavel than to any other uninspired author.
That's right. Yeah.
Very, very, very popular, very influential.
Wow.
And I think in some ways, though, interestingly, and I don't know why, but sometime probably maybe in the 1800s, he kind of maybe drifted to the periphery. And so he's known only for maybe a few of his works. But But what he actually wrote was much more substantial, and not much attention has been given to him within, you know, academic circles. Or you know, you find people like Perkins or Ames or right. others who, you know, dissertations have been written on, but to my knowledge, nothing has been written on Flavel to that extent.
Wow. Now, could you connect him to the present day? Maybe we need to rehearse a little bit of the discussions on union with Christ and how it relates to justification and the other benefits in the Ordo Salutis. Can you briefly summarize that as you do in the article, and then we can proceed and to see how Flavel actually anticipated many of the present discussions?
Yeah. Yeah, of course, it's a, you know, it's lots been written,
sure.
as you mentioned, in this, you know, back and forth, and continues to be. It'll be interesting to see how that conversation continues. But you know, you guys, of course, can add in, but I'd summarize it this way. You know, there's a concern among some that if you emphasize union with Christ as the starting point for the doctrine, the doctrines of salvation, the various benefits, justification, sanctification, etc. Yeah. That if union with Christ comes first, and all of these are received in union, in relationship with the person of Christ, I think the concern that some have is that the significance of justification will be lost. That maybe within that union, justification will become intermingled in some ways with the other benefits of salvation, and that alien righteousness that is Jesus's alone and imputed to us, that will be lost in the union that we have with Christ if union comes first. And so there's been a concern to protect the uniqueness of justification, and maybe a concern that uniqueness gets lost if we talk about it in the context of union with Christ. On the other hand, there are those who say, well, no, if union with Christ is understood properly, justification remains that unique, distinct, you know, forensic element of our salvation, where we are declared righteous within the context of the relationship that we have with Christ. And so there's been this back and forth of kind of how salvation is structured. Does union with Christ stand at the forefront as the context within which we receive all the benefits, or is justification primary? Hmm. And are all the other parts of salvation connected and flow under the doctrine of justification?
Yeah.
And that's turned into a historical theological argument as well. What does the history of Reformed theology say? What does Calvin say? Of course, you have individuals like Dr. Gaffin and Dr. Tipton, Mark Garcia, and others who say Gaffin emphasizes union with Christ as the main primary category under which the other parts of salvation are connected to one another and understood. Mm-hmm. And there are others that say, well, no, Calvin says justification is the main hinge on which religion turns. It's the primary category in the way Calvin and Reformed theology understands salvation.
Yeah, and even within this, not, I don't mean to interrupt, but just to interject for the sake of the listeners, there's also another angle in which some people will say union with Christ is a distinctly Reformed understanding, that it is the context of salvation. It's an umbrella term of sorts. I believe John Fesco teaches this in his book on justification. But yet, even within that, then there is a priority of justification to sanctification.
Yes.
They would not accept an understanding of definitive sanctification, but then they would see justification causing sanctification. Of course, Dr. Horton teaches in his several books, and we've done some discussions on this also, that justification is the forensic basis and the source of everything, in a sense, for him, of calling, effectual calling, regeneration, you know, sanctification, even glorification.
Pulls the train.
So there's all sorts of different ways in which these things can be configured. But even within people that would say a union with Christ is a an important context for the whole of the Ordo Salutis. I would categorize John Fesco there, Carl Truman there. There would still be some that hold on to a logical priority, maybe even a causal priority, and that's where people like Dr. Gaffin, Lane Tipton, and Mark Garcia would reject that. And they would appeal to Calvin and his teaching on the duplex gratia. Yeah, Jared.
Just one more name that rarely gets mentioned in these discussions, probably because the debate side isn't emphasized as much. But Sinclair Ferguson is crystal clear on this. When he talks about union with Christ and then the precedent, obviously, with John Owen and a few others that he takes. So I would put him.
He's with Gaffin.
He taught with Gaffin, mm-hmm. So he's well aware of like the debate, but more the positive context of where he's coming from in emphasizing union with Christ.
Yeah, thanks, that's right. For the reminder. You see that very mm-hmm. clearly in his work on the Holy Spirit, book, the Holy Spirit, where he describes that. But yeah, I think the question is, try to put it very simply: is do some blow out of proportion the significance of union with Christ in Calvin? Some have said that's individuals like Dr. Gaffin, it's almost like a new perspective on Calvin or a Gaffin school on Calvin that emphasizes union in such a way that you can't really, find in Calvin. You can't subsume the whole of his soteriology under that category of union with Christ. And so individuals like Fesco, call that into question and look to the 17th century and say, well, can you prove it? Can you prove, as you look at the development of Reformed Orthodoxy into the 17th century, that union with Christ held that place of primary importance? Mm. And that's where I think Flavel is important. I think Flavel, the answer is yes. Flavel demonstrates a continuity. I think with Calvin and on through the 17th century, and the way Flavel talks about union with Christ, I believe is very similar to what you hear in individuals such as Sinclair Ferguson, of course, who knows the Puritans very well, and Dr. Gaffin and others. And I think that's why Flavel is so important too, is because he provides us with a vantage point towards the end of the 17th century. Looking back, he's a century after Calvin or more, and he's a good generation. He's writing a generation after the Westminster Assembly. And so he provides us with a vantage point looking back on the development of these issues. And he doesn't see himself as an innovator. He's a pastor communicating the tradition and ministering it to his people.
Yeah, that's good. Just one more thing, and then maybe others have, or maybe Camden has a question. But
others,
in terms of how the confession relates to this, the question for the current discussion is the emphasis on union with Christ confessional? And I think part in this article you mentioned Flavel is not clearly ignorant of the confession. So I don't know if this is getting ahead of ourselves, but maybe quickly, could you mention Flavel's knowledge of the confession? How he stands with it, what he's trying to do, because clearly he's written a couple things on it.
Yeah, that's right. One of Flavel's works you find in volume 6 of his collected works is his exposition of the Assembly's Catechism. And of course, he's talking about the Westminster Assembly's Catechism, the shorter catechism. And it was actually published posthumously, but it was something he wrote for his congregation. So all he's doing is expositing the Reformed theology, what he believes the Bible teaches, to his congregation. And as he deals with the question of what is effectual calling, he has a heading above that question of our union with Christ. And then he outlines 12 other questions to give the sense of what our union with Christ is. And so he sees the union with Christ as an important element in what the Catechism is teaching, and we'll move forward. We'll see some particular ways in which he does that. But it's very clear that Flavel sees himself as expositor of the Reformed tradition. He sees himself standing, within it, ministering out of it, and you see that as he talks about the Westminster Catechism very clearly. And one of the things, well, this may be getting ahead of ourselves too, but you know, as he moves on, as he talks about union with Christ, the way he talks about justification, sanctification, adoption, he calls those the concomitants of vocation. That's the heading he gives to those. So he deals union with Christ, and here's what union with Christ is, and our effectual calling. It unites us to Jesus by the Spirit and by faith. And then when he gets to the benefits, he calls them the concomitants of vocation, in other words, the things that go along with our calling, the associated blessings that we receive in our union with Christ. And that's when he talks about justification, sanctification, and so on. So he provides for us kind of at a macro level, in his headings, the way he understands the structure of things as he works through the catechism.
So there are a few terms that highlight different aspects of union with Christ. There's eternal union and election, our union with Christ's accomplished work in redemptive history, and the application of that accomplished work to the life of the individual believer. Could you talk a little bit about the historical precedent for these aspects that you've seen in Flavel? How does Flavel talk about union with Christ, and how does he, characterize the different facets of that doctrine?
Yeah, for Flavel, at kind of the macro level of his soteriology, there's he begins with a hypostatic union, which of course is the union of the second person of the Trinity with our humanity, and he talks about that in terms of redemption accomplished. That union was necessary, that Jesus or that the Son would join himself with our humanity. And so that's one union. But one of the things he says, and this is very similar with many others who write on this topic, that the hypostatic union alone is not enough to for us to be saved.
Yeah. Unless you're Karl Rahner.
That's right. Others outside of our tradition may say that. but he would say that's not sufficient. And one of the things that he says, and again, this isn't unique to Flavel. Many who are writing on union with Christ at the same time say similar things, that union is a blessing that is common to all of humanity, both to those who are elect and those who are not. But then he goes on to describe the mystical union with Christ, which is, kind of more the one that is being discussed in our circles today,
right.
As the personal union, as the union between the elect and Jesus that is accomplished by his Spirit and through faith. And so there's the hypostatic union, what Christ accomplishes in our humanity, but then we only receive that when we are united to him in faith, which is affected by the work of the Spirit and our effectual calling. And so there's the hypostatic union, there's the mystical union, but then another important category, and I think maybe this hasn't been discussed as much in the recent conversations, is the communion that we have with Christ. And I think this you see very clearly in the larger catechism as well, that the union that we have with the person of Jesus brings us into a state of communion with Jesus. And it's in that communion with him that all the benefits and blessings flow to us. It's the relationship with his person is established first. And then we receive all the blessings that come from that relationship we have with him. Mm. Justification, adoption, sanctification being primary ones. Mm-hmm. And so that's the larger framework and some of the terminology that Flavel is using at a macro level to talk about the structure of salvation.
Yeah. Those are really handy and I think reorients our thoughts about the subject so that we can understand a little more fully what's going on here. We can't understand union with Christ in any sense without understanding, in some regard, all senses. I mean, we can't understand the mystical union without the covenantal union. There's no ground or foundation for it. Likewise, if we don't understand how the Son of God became man, he could not have been our covenantal head as he is. And we couldn't have the mystical union either there. So that's helpful. I appreciate that. that link there. I should say, moving on to this subject, how does Flavel walk the line between stressing the benefits of justification? We see that the benefits come out of union with Christ, but how does Flavel in particular lay out that architecture, that map? How does he describe the relation between them? Some people would say that, even though union with Christ might be the umbrella or the overarching context, yet there's still kind of a substructure in which justification, then sanctification, that there's still some priority among the benefits. How does Flavel talk about this?
One of the things that I mentioned in the paper, Flavel does talk about justification as being the language he uses is the sweetest of the blessings that we receive from Christ.
Yeah.
And so he does, and he uses other language where he very clearly magnifies the place of justification in the benefits that we receive. But as I read Flavel, it seems pretty clear to me that what he's describing there isn't theological priority in the sense that justification then is first and the others flow from it, as much as he's emphasizing the uniqueness of that grace and our experience of it, because he talks about how justification, Jesus comes to us as great sinners and he bestows his righteousness freely upon us, that it gives us great assurance, because it doesn't depend upon anything we've accomplished, but solely on what Christ has imputed. And so he magnifies, justification without giving it theological priority or basing the other benefits.
That's a good way to put it. That's a great way to put it. And of course, we should reiterate that many people that are eschewing a sort of causal priority between justification and sanctification are working with, at least the best of them, are working with an understanding of sanctification that they derive mainly from Romans 6, but many other places, 1 Corinthians 1, verse 2, verse 30, chapter 6, verse 11, etc. There are a number of places that speak about sanctification as this breach, definitive breach with the power of sin, in which the believer, the dominion of sin or its power has been broken. It doesn't mean that there is no longer any indwelling sin. It just means that the believer now, having been united to Christ, is no longer a slave to sin, but rather a slave to righteousness. So they have the freedom now not to sin. And so that's a definitive breach, a once-for-all break in its power, not only in its in the guilt that it provides. So justification handles the guilt. Sanctification, initially, definitive sanctification breaks its power and its corruption, pollution, but then progressive sanctification works throughout an entire person's life as the Spirit applies the death and resurrection of Christ to the individual such that they are endeavoring after righteousness, they're being molded more into the image of Christ, and at the time in which they die or when the Lord returns, then sanctification will be complete in their glorification and the bodily resurrection. So that's a particular thing in the background. It's a long way to try to lay out this this landscape. But my question, to get to the point, is does Flavel work with any notion of sanctification like this? Or does he have some theological category to describe this break with sin's power? Or is he strictly speaking in progressive terms?
He's speaking in more than just progressive progressive terms. I have a brief paragraph on this where he, and this is to quote him, he talks about, quote, initial and progressive sanctification.
Interesting.
And of course, I think it would be wrong for us to read into that maybe some of, what we read in John Murray and his discussion of definitive sanctification. I think it'd be important not to read everything that we reading from John Murray or others into that, but he does make a distinction because what he's concerned to do is to say, look, when you come into union with Christ, in the communion that you have with him, all of these blessings are now yours. And so he's important to say that it's important for him that he communicates that the righteousness of Christ is yours by imputation.
Yeah.
Also, he talks about, and this is also to quote, that you're free from the dominion as well as the guilt of sin, he says. Mm-hmm. And so yes, he's operating with both of those categories while clearly distinguishing the benefits from one another. And I think that's very important to note.
Well, it's very important, yeah.
Because that's a concern, that's in this current debate. He talks about how justification is by the imputed righteousness of Christ, and that imputation is grounded on our union. It's because of the relationship we have with Jesus that his righteousness can be counted as ours. Yeah. And then that, of course, is the basis of ourselves being declared as righteous in him because of the relationship that we have with him. But then he talks about how in sanctification, he takes a different method. It's not the same. It's not imputed, but he says it's really imparted to us.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm. By the Spirit. He does free us from the dominion of sin and begins to transform us into his image. And so he's very careful to distinguish the benefits within this union, but they're all had in the communion that we have with Jesus because of the relationship established with him.
That's really fascinating. And this happening, in the 17th century, which is really brings things right around.
Yeah, Rob, just a quick follow-up on that. I've also heard it objected, or definitive sanctification being objected to on the grounds that we don't really need it, that it's rolled up into regeneration. And so this does seem to at least make us pause with that kind of objection and say, while not, as you put it, identical with what Murray's doing on definitive sanctification, there is at least some precedent to how Murray was talking about it, in seed form in the 17th century, that it's not, just a brand new innovation, that it didn't just come out of nowhere because he really liked the doctrine, but he was seeing something within the tradition that was present already, again, in seed form.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's clear. That because what Flavel is doing, again, this isn't unique to Flavel, as he talks about our union with Christ and how we receive everything, all his benefits, those benefits address different dimensions of sin, right? And so sin makes me guilty and separates me from God. Therefore, I need righteousness, and that righteousness is found in my relationship with Christ because his is attributed to me because of the relationship I have with him. But that's not my only problem with sin. I'm also under its dominion. I'm under its power. And sanctification addresses that need, where Jesus breaks the power of reigning sin. He begins to conform us to his image. And so that's what Flavel is doing. He's saying these are different benefits that come to us because of our union with Christ that address all of the various dimensions of sin, differently and uniquely, because sin has different and unique dimensions that the gospel must address.
Yeah, great, great point. Well, and you also bring up another figure, William Ames. And what I appreciated was you looked at him closely, you found a couple quotes that seem to point to both sides of the discussion, that one quote you give, and we can go into specifics, seems to support the notion of justification having priority to union with Christ. And then there's another quote in Ames that seems to go the other way. So I guess the question is, how do you relate it to Flavel, I guess, in what he's doing, but also within Ames himself, can we reconcile those two things without, unnecessary harmonization or something?
Right. That's a good question. I think it's important to see, again, we're talking about macro level issues and then micro level issues when it comes to understanding the structure of salvation. And Ames has been quoted by Horton and Fesco in support of their prioritizing justification. But I think if you step back and look at Ames, You see, he says things very similarly to Flavel. Again, Flavel's not unique. He's within the tradition. And here's one quote from Ames where Ames says the parts of application, talking about the application of salvation, the parts of application are two: union with Christ and partaking of the benefits that flow from this union. And so that's very similar, I think, to what we read in the Westminster Standards that talk about union with Christ and the communion we have with him. And similarly in Flavel, the union we have with Christ, which is focused on our relationship with his person, and then the communion we have with his privileges. Mm-hmm. So my point there was to show that Ames also talks about union with Christ as being primary in our understanding of the application of redemption. He says, and this again is to quote him, he says it's the first consideration in the application of redemption. He even goes so far to say that we are justified by the union, that it's within the context of union that justification happens. Now, at the micro level, which you're pointing out, and I don't have these quotes before me, but when he gets to sanctification and justification, the relationship, he does talk about justification, and justification as being a context within which sanctification happens. He describes justification as the relative change. And what he's talking about there is that it changes our relationship with God, us relative to God. We are now righteous. But then he talks about sanctification as the real change that issues out from that union and in the context of our justification. And I think that's important. I think we can say that sanctification always happens in the context of our justification, because it's both are received in union with Christ. Mm-hmm. So there is never progress in sanctification that does not take into consideration that we are justified. And that's essential for progress in sanctification, because it affects how we look upon ourselves, that we move forward in sanctification, not in fear, but in confidence because of the status we have before God in Jesus, that we are righteous. And mm-hmm. that is being what God has declared us to be. He is now working out in our lives through the power of Jesus, who's died to sin and raised to newness of life.
Could one way to put it, affirm everything that you said, but also say that justification in that sense, in one sense, is not distinct, although, of course, we never want to downplay it. But in other words, you know, we could say the same thing of adoption. Progress in sanctification can look back to your adoption and your acceptance as, you know, a son, an adopted son in Christ. And so that there's a range of things that help us in our progressive sanctification, which is, again, we don't have to get into this, but one of the things that I appreciate about definitive sanctification, because that's dealing with a separate issue in one sense. But progress in sanctification, yeah, we want to affirm that there are a whole host of things, definitely including justification, that will help us in that.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. And that's, I think, the value of seeing union with Christ as primary, and then we have communion with him and all these benefits, is that each benefit reinforces the other. And so that my righteous status encourages me to make progress even as I continue to fail. I don't do so with, out of fear, but I do so in great hope, because I'm already counted as a son of God. I'm already counted righteous in Christ. And of course, sanctification is part of is an important aspect too of how we understand our justification and our adoption. Flavel goes back to is he's one of the things he's addressing in his own era, his own day, is a climate of antinomianism, which only maybe emphasizes justification exclusively, but shows no concern for righteousness. And Flavel says he talks about how you cannot divide Christ. If you receive him in union with him, you get all of him. And so this justification and sanctification included, you can't have one without the other.
Yeah, that's a great point. Rob, just to wrap things up, I think there's a lot of value, and this is a very important article. And one thing you mentioned in here is just some of the assessment of Gaffin's particular view on Calvin, and it's shared by a number of others. Well, Flavel and Ames are two theologians, but I think you've indicated and alluded to the fact that these views might be a little bit more widespread. But just to cut to the quick, would you say that it's accurate to say that Gaffin's particular view is idiosyncratic? You footnote Fesco on that, or historically suspect? You footnote Godfrey and Van Drunen on that subject. What is your end of the day, or end of the article, at least, take on those assessments?
Yes, I think as you read Flavel, and again, you see his own historical precedents, of which there are many, that it is impossible to read Gaffin and others who agree with him as somehow offering a new spin on the development of Reformed theology. As I read Gaffin, and as I think what Gaffin and others are saying is a restatement in many ways of what you find in Flavel, that there's nothing new that these individuals are saying. And so it's somewhat shocking to me. It's a very bold statement. And I just do not think that historical theology can show that to be true. I think Dr. Gaffin, Dr. Tipton, and Mark Garcia, others, Bill Evans, are well within what Reformed theology has historically said. And I think you see that, and maybe we didn't mention this, and we should, that the key work here in Flavel for seeing his understanding of union with Christ is his work, The Method of Grace. And if anyone's interested, I think there'll be a link to this at your site. If you just want to read sermons number 2, number 6, and number 8, just those three, I think will demonstrate that, where you see an overview of union, how we enter into it by faith in his person. The focus is on his person, and then his privileges, then what we receive from him. And then in Sermon 8, he talks about the communion that we have and the different benefits and how they're related to Jesus and how they come to us through our union with him. And I think what you'll find there is very similar to what you find in Dr. Gaffin and some of the others who agree with him.
Mm. Well, Rob, I really appreciate that. And of course, not all of our listeners are going to agree, but that's the beauty of scholarship. And so we encourage you to read the article. We hope this will whet your appetite. And the article is available through the Westminster Theological Journal. Jared's spoken with somebody that said we can post it on the website. I'm still a little suspicious about that. So we're going to follow up on that, see what we can do. I hate to tell you that, Jared, but at least
you can embed it, you know, with the Scrib version. Anyway, we can get into that another time.
we'll see what we can do. But regardless, you know, if you have access to a theological library, you can get it. But also, it's the PDFs for archived issues are indexed. You can find it one way or the other. So check that out, the Westminster Theological Journal. Rob, before we let you go, can you tell us a little bit more about your work, or maybe just provide for us a web link or something? Do you have a website up already?
Yes, I do. Mercypres.org.
Okay.
It's our web address. And I've been here for about 2 years.
Yeah.
And we're still a mission church. And in our denomination, that means we don't have our own session of elders or deacons yet. But we hope to, we're just starting that process actually this fall, and hope to complete it sometime later in the spring. So, that's kind of where we're at.
Great. I appreciate that. And Jared, I guess I might have got things wrong with your title. You've changed a little bit. Do you have a new title now at Westminster?
It looks like the new title is communications manager.
Okay.
Not a whole lot is going to change except for the addition of a few things. But yeah, I guess that would be the new title, which reminds me I need to get new cards and maybe a couple other things. New email signature at least.
Well, you can visit Jared online, of course, at ts.edu. You can find many of the fruits of many of his labors there. So visit Westminster Theological Seminary online. We thank them for all their historic support of Reform Forum. Even though we're not on campus anymore, they're still a big help in many ways. And of course, you can visit us online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs, and you'll be able to keep up to date with everything that we're up to, including our newest program, East of Eden. If you'd like to get a hold of us, please email us at mail@reformedforum.org or tweet us at Reformed Forum. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.